Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Gather your friends and family at the second annual Catskill Cuisine Festival, presented by the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, Bethel Woods Center for the Arts, and Resorts World Catskills. Mark your calendars for a flavor-packed weekend from May 10th to May 12th. Experience the fusion of phenomenal food and electrifying entertainment. Rub shoulders with your favorite Food Network personalities, including Andrew Zimmern, Michael Simon, Scott Conant, Marcus Samuelson, Jeffrey Zakarian, Anne Burrell, Melba Wilson, and distinguished international chefs by LaBelle Farms. Kick off the festivities with Friday's star-studded golf tournament and evening reception. Saturday heats up with free tastings, thrilling live demos, music, and family activities, culminating with a gourmet dinner hosted by celebrity chefs. And on Sunday, celebrate Mother's Day with a special celebrity-curated brunch. Tickets for this celebration are selling like hotcakes. Visit Catskill-Cuisine.com to grab your pass for this unforgettable weekend in the picturesque Catskills. See you there.
This is Capri Cafaro, host of Eat Your Heartland Out. On the next episode, we are doing a deep dive into Iowa's culinary culture with food historian, author, and Iowa storyteller Darcy Molesby. We will go beyond corn and pork tenderloins to explore everything from indigenous farming traditions to how the chop suey craze swept Des Moines in the early 20th century. Darcy, thank you for joining Eat Your Heartland Out.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here, Capri.
You have done so much work as a food historian, author, and Iowa storyteller, which I absolutely love. What inspired you to kind of go on this path to be that Iowa storyteller that you are today?
Well, you know, I'm trained as an ag journalist. I grew up on a century farm here in Northwest Iowa, and I've been covering ag stories for almost 30 years. And I would write about food and farming, which is, I mean, it's a natural fit. And I would sit in these kitchens of some of these old school farm cooks, and I would listen to how they prepared the food. They'd share these recipes with me. Usually we'd get to sample it because I swear our state motto should be, we don't meet if we don't eat.
I love that.
Right? Right? And so I was capturing all these stories and these recipes, and I would ask these, it's usually ladies, I would ask them, so do your children, do your grandchildren make these recipes? And they would say, no, sadly, a lot of times they don't. They're too busy or whatever. They don't like to cook. And I just thought, wow, this heritage, this culinary heritage really needs to be preserved. And so that's what led me to do some of my first books about Iowa's culinary history. And then that just seems to have captured a lot of people's interest. And I keep telling stories and sharing more history. So it's great fun.
Well, and it is both, you know, informing and obviously appetizing as well. You know, I want to get into all of your books and writings in a minute. But, you know, first, you know, for folks that may not be familiar, and obviously it's the mission of this program to kind of be a myth buster when it comes to, you know, the richness of Midwestern culinary heritage and you know, that culinary landscape that we have. People may be asking the question, is there really a culinary history or tradition in Iowa, right? Like, what do they have? Is it corn? Like, you know, is there what else besides corn? What would you tell folks that might be skeptics about, you know, a rich culinary tradition coming out of Iowa?
you know, we do have one. And sometimes even Iowans ourselves don't always recognize that, because when I was working on my Culinary History of Iowa manuscript and people would ask me what I was up to, I would talk about this book and they would look at me funny and say, "What? Iowa has a culinary history?" And I said, "Absolutely." So it's really based in a lot of meat and potatoes type cooking, but it's spiced with a surprising amount of ethnic influences. And I say there's two factors going on about why that is. The first is that because we are such a farming state, when you are a farmer, you don't just pack up and move every few years, even though we live in a very mobile, modern 21st century society. So we've got these generations of history that are tied to the land. And so we've got families carrying on a lot of these culinary traditions long after a lot of other ethnic traditions fade away. The food remains. And so we've got that going on. And then Iowa's really becoming a dynamic, diverse place anymore, because we've got people from all over the world that come here for jobs and different reasons. And so we've got everything from Southeast Asian flavors to Hispanic and Latin flavors and African flavors. It's just really a diverse, interesting food scene that blends the best of the past and the future.
I think, have captured it beautifully. And I guess that is, again, why you are an Iowa storyteller. Let me turn to one of the books that you've written, and that is Classic Restaurants of Des Moines and Their Recipes. And, you know, you just mentioned, you know, so many of these dynamic ethnic flavors. And one of the chapters in this book is Midwestern Roots Mixed with Ethnic Accents. Tell me a little bit about this chapter in this book. You know, we're talking about restaurants, we're talking about the foods that they serve, and there's some surprising history when it comes to, you know, particularly Asian and Asian American food traditions that have come out of restaurants that have been established in Des Moines. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I even surprised myself when I was working on that book, because the first chapter is all about Chinese food and chop suey. But if you trace our culinary history back, especially in a city like Des Moines, you can't overlook the impact in the late 1800s, early 1900s of this whole chop suey craze, which was actually sweeping the entire country. But it led to one of the longest running restaurants, go figure, in Des Moines with King Ying Lo. So a lot of this goes back to when a Chinese foreign minister made a state visit to the United States. It was really, they called it a highly ballyhooed official visit. Don't you love that?
When it's ballyhooed, you know it's a big deal.
Oh, yes, indeed. So he landed in New York, first of all, and that's where all the big city, the New York press, just is captivated with this man who was named Li Hung Chang, and talking about how he dressed, what he ate, and even his opinion on whether women should ride bicycles, which was a big topic in the late 1800s. Right.
Yes.
And so all this, all things Chinese, just became the rage. And this even trickled out to places like Des Moines, which was still kind of a smaller frontier town at that time. But that's when we start seeing places like King Ying Lo opened. And this was around 1907 at this point. And it just created this culinary sensation. So if you were out at the theater at night and you wanted a place to go get a meal or a snack before you headed home, and you know, you're the upper crust, you've got time to do this, you go to a place like King Ying Lo and you eat stuff like chop suey, because this was just such a flavor sensation compared to maybe the more bland, traditional, standard fare that Midwesterners were used to.
Now, when you were doing your research for this, did you come across any maybe reviews or articles of people, you know, at the time, contemporaries, and as you said, I think 1906 or 1908, experiencing the chop suey at King Ying Lo's and how they felt about those flavors when they tasted them?
You know, I did, because when I was digging into some of the old Des Moines Evening Tribune newspapers, about 1924, so now this is a little bit later in time, but it's talking about the cook at this restaurant. It says Li Din is going home. So it talks about the 22 years prior of him cooking in Des Moines and serving out of various restaurants. And I love that some of the descriptions at that time. It said, nimbly, Lee's fingers have shifted the wooden spheres on the ebony counting board, and, you know, talking about tallying up checks. But then it talks about the hungry, happy crowds who patronized King Ying Lo. Mm-hmm. And apparently the restaurant back then had marble top tables. And so,
wow.
Yeah, I know, pretty upscale dining. And so this cook had come down from Minneapolis, St. Paul. He ends up in Des Moines because a fellow Chinese friend had said, hey, you should go to Des Moines because there could be good money in the restaurant business there. And also he said, Des Moines people are good people with whom to deal. So he opens a chop suey restaurant called the Palm Garden Cafe. That was his first place. And it said in the newspapers, it was crowded with customers from the first noon lunch. And here's a quote for you. The guests ate up all the food that had been purchased for the entire day for that meal. People continued to throng, and by the restaurant would no longer hold all who would come. So he has two more expansions, grows into a bigger place down on Mulberry Street. And so I love the fact that the newspaper took the time to capture that little slice of history.
Love it. I absolutely love it. But now it is gone, right?
Yes, that is part of the past now.
But the legend still remains, and obviously a lot of other flavors are still there lining the streets of Des Moines. Another, I want to kind of stick with this book and kind of stick with this, the theme of ethnic flavors that are informing Des Moines food scene. And one of your chapters is authentic Italian influences.
Yeah.
And so tell me a little bit about those Italian influences coming in from Calabria and how the Italian immigrant experience then shaped the food scene there throughout the 20th century.
Absolutely. You cannot tell the story of central Iowa and particularly Des Moines from a food perspective without that Italian influence. There were just so many great, and still are, so many great Italian restaurateurs in this part of our state. So one of the businesses that really reflects this whole Italian culinary heritage, especially in Des Moines, would have to be Graziano Brothers. It's actually a little corner grocery store, but its roots go back well over 100 years. And it was two young brothers who came from Calabria. Like so many of their predecessors, their friends and family from that part of the world, an agricultural region, but at this time, over 100 years ago, this was really more of it was a tough time to make a living in that part of southern Italy. Mm-hmm. And so this was the period, the early 1900s, when immigration patterns had shifted somewhat from Western Europe to more of that Italian, Eastern European region. And so these two brothers come to Des Moines to try and make a new start. But what they started was not in the food business. They started working for the railroad because that was a huge industry at the time. Mm-hmm. A lot of their compatriots would have worked in the coal mines, which were also a huge industry in this area at the time. But, you know, both of those jobs leave a lot to be desired. It's good, honest work, but it's very hard work. And frankly, it's tough to make a good living. So these two brothers wanted to really explore more options and see if they could carry on some of these culinary traditions. So one brother said, if we can pool enough money, I'll start a grocery store. And then if it takes off, then you join me. And that's exactly what happened. So now it's a third generation family owned business. It's on South Union Street in South Des Moines, mm-hmm. same place it's been forever. And you can get all your wonderful Italian foods here. You can get the famous Graziano sausages. You can get San Marzano tomatoes, cannoli, you name it. It's a feast for the senses. And then this is also this type of story of coming to America, working together as a family, preserving these wonderful Italian flavors. This tradition is alive in so many of our wonderful Italian restaurants, both past and present, that are in Des Moines.
What you are describing sounds very much like my hometown in Ohio. As a matter of fact, just replace railroads with steel mills. Mm-hmm. We have coal mines not too far, southeastern Ohio, as well as western Pennsylvania, and the panhandle of West Virginia as well. And so, I mean, that's why I'm always so fascinated by the stories that food tells, because they capture, you know, migration patterns and immigration patterns, and they tell an economic story.
That is a great point too, Capri, because especially this place, Graziano's, it was and is such an interwoven part of that community. I love to hear the family tell about how in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, the folks who were running that at the time, they were so gracious and so compassionate to their neighbors and their friends and family, because times were tough and money was scarce. Mm-hmm. And sometimes folks just could not always pay their grocery bill on time. And these folks floated a lot of credit during the Great Depression, and people mm-hmm. still, generations later, families still remember that kindness and compassion.
Oh, no question. And again, that's why, you know, food oftentimes is an anchor for communities at large. Mm-hmm. So interesting. I mean, I taking a look at these books and just listening to you speak about the work and the research that's gone into them are, you know, definitely I'm learning quite a bit. I want to shift focus just a little bit over to another book, your book entitled A Culinary History of Iowa, Sweet Corn, Pork Tenderloins, Made Rights, and More. So for folks that are not familiar, I mean, people are usually know about sweet corn and pork tenderloins, but I want to talk about their, you know, particular significance in Iowa. But what are made rights? What is that?
Yeah, the made rights, they go back almost 100 years. They're essentially a loose meat ground beef sandwich.
So like a sloppy Joe type of scenario?
Close. Think sloppy Joe without the sloppy. So there was, so the story goes that there was a butcher in Muscatine, Iowa, which is along the Mississippi River on the east side of the state. So back in 1926, he was experimenting with some different grinds of beef. So he ground that meat really fine. He adds some salt and pepper. And so we got these loose meat crumbles. He puts it in a bun and he allegedly gives it to a friend. And the friend samples it and says, "Fred, that sandwich is made right." So we still have the made right tradition in this state. There are some actual made right brand restaurants. But you asked about sloppy Joe's. So sometimes people try and use those terms interchangeably, but a made right is not a sloppy Joe. So what the difference is, like a sloppy Joe has the ketchup, the brown sugar, things that add that sauce that makes it sloppy. Whereas a made right, true made right, is basically steamed ground beef, usually not much more than salt and pepper. You serve it with a bun, and a lot of times the restaurants will serve, they'll give you a spoon, because that loose meat can be a little tricky to eat. But when it's prepared right, it's deceptively simple, but it's really delicious. And it's so funny because these things have so many different names across the state and even across the Midwest. So if you go to the northwest mm-hmm. part of the state, they'll call them taverns. So don't be alarmed if tavern is on the menu. It's just another name for these made rights. Sometimes they're generically called loose meat sandwiches. I've heard them called beef burgers. And the funniest comment was that a lady from Southern Illinois heard one of my programs about our culinary history. This was over in Davenport, Iowa. And she says, "I know what those sandwiches are. We call them Yip Yips." So I have to say Yip Yip wins for most fun name for that sandwich.
True. I mean, I'm going to have to keep my eye peeled for all these different names of sandwiches. I mean, I feel like we might need a quick guide, like a Cliff Notes.
Yeah, like a glossary.
Exact glossary. There you go. A glossary. I know when we had spoken, previous to this, you had mentioned that there are a lot of hyper-regional food traditions in Iowa. So not only do you have these names that are kind of hyper-regional to something like a made right, which is pretty iconic, but there are actually, you know, kind of very hyper-regional food traditions within Iowa. Give me some examples.
Yeah, so two spring to mind right away. And if I bring up either of these terms to most Iowans, if they're not from that region, they'll look at me and say, "What are you talking about?" So one of them is the steak de burgo, and the other is raw dog. So you will find steak de burgos usually in those Italian restaurants in the Des Moines metro, and usually not a whole mm-hmm. lot farther beyond that area. So you have a beautiful cut of steak, and essentially you're putting a garlicky cream sauce on top. So mm-hmm. very rich, very luxurious, very fun to eat, and very simple to make, but I love my steak de Burgo. And then raw dog is at the total other end of the spectrum. This is more up in Northeast Iowa, in along the river, along the Mississippi, largely around Guttenberg and towns like that. But raw dog is essentially kind of like steak tartare. So you've got the raw ground beef and scoop it on a cracker. And basically the debate becomes, do you eat it on a Ritz or a saltine? I'm not brave enough. Yeah, I know. I'm not brave enough to do the raw dog thing. But one other one that I have had, this is turkey. Is a turkey dressing sandwich. And these things are just huge in the Dubuque area, which is another big river town along our eastern seaboard, as we call it, along the Mississippi River. And so this is just like starchapalooza. So take your leftover turkey from Thanksgiving and mix in the dressing and just it's like this casserole conglomeration of lots of starch. And really, the turkey dressing sandwiches, when they make them from scratch, they're not just taking Thanksgiving leftovers. They make these things all the time throughout the year. You'll see them on at graduation reception buffets. You'll see them at wedding receptions. So if you hear about turkey dressing sandwiches, that's a hyper-local thing from the Dubuque, Iowa area.
I mean, I would be all about that. I have to be honest. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I could definitely be the Thanksgiving year-round person for sure. So I may have to take a special trip to Dubuque. Now, tell us a little bit about chili and cinnamon rolls, because this is this is one of these kind of Midwest debates of how you have your chili, and this is kind of specific to Iowa.
It really is. We can't totally claim this as our own, but it really is a hyper-regional food. And I used to think, because I grew up with this as my favorite school lunch, I just thought every kid in Iowa grew up with this. They did not. And either, if I say chili and cinnamon rolls, depending on where you're from and what you grew up with, you will either say, oh, that was the best. I still love that. Or, oh, that's gross. That makes no sense. That's like eating scrambled eggs and birthday cake together. So it's really simple. It's just a bowl of chili. And then in my school, we had those wonderful retired farm wife cooks when I was growing up. So they would make, they were caramel rolls actually, rather than cinnamon rolls, but they would start making.
Sounds fantastic.
Oh my gosh, it was wonderful. So you'd have your chili for the main course, you'd have this roll for dessert. And our school was built in 1923. It's one of those three-story old school brick buildings. And the kitchen was down in the basement. And I remember those gals would make those rolls from scratch. And so first thing in the morning, you're in math class and you could smell the smell of the rolls. The aroma was just drifting all the way up through all those floors of the school. And you were so hungry for lunch. So it's a wonderful tradition.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I've actually never tried it. I know that it is a thing, and it's something that I'm going to have to check out. Now, let me talk a little bit and shift gears to fairs and festivals and celebrations. This is another chapter in this book, because, you know, I think that the layperson out there, you know, when you think about Iowa, you think about, oh, the Iowa State Fair, you hear about it. And, you know, every politician in the world goes to the Iowa State Fair to try something on a stick. What kind of significance do these fairs, not just the state fair, but the, you know, the county fairs and other types of festival traditions, what do they bring to the table when it comes to unique Iowan culinary culture?
Yeah, you know, they are so intertwined with our agricultural history. That's what they grew out of, was a place to exhibit your best livestock, your best pies, your best jams, your best vegetables. You would get to exhibit these at county fairs. And then, of course, the big kahuna is the Iowa State Fair, which is one of those things. I think everybody really needs to go see it at some point in their lifetime. It's down in Des Moines. It's been on the same place since the 1880s, if I remember correctly. It might even predate that a little bit. But yeah, you can still go through some of the old barns that have been there for generations, and you can see these wonderful food products. And better yet, you can eat your way through the fair. Now, I've done both. Yeah, exactly. I have competed in the food competitions at the Iowa State Fair. I'm very proud to say I won a blue ribbon for my mixed berry jam. You know, and that
oh, wow.
It sounds a little cheesy, but that's actually a big deal because this is the biggest.
It's a huge deal.
Yeah, it's the biggest food department of any state fair in the whole country. So I got my little prize there. But anybody can go and have a ball at this fair because there's food everywhere. And some of my favorites, you kind of alluded to this with talking about the everything on a stick. And yes, we have plenty of politicians that find their way to the fair and they all want their grip and grin picture of them grilling a pork chop on a stick at the pork tent. And that's all well and good. I personally like to head over to the Cattleman's Beef Quarters restaurant because one of my all-time favorite foods has to be the hot beef sundae. So hats off to who?
Whoa, okay.
Yeah.
What is that about?
It's so fantastic. So instead of an ice cream sundae, it takes its inspiration from that, but it's done with meat and potatoes. So your ice cream.
That's awesome.
Isn't that cool? So instead of having a scoop of vanilla, they put a scoop of mashed potatoes in your cup or your dish. And then for your topping, instead of hot fudge, you get this wonderful beef gravy. So it's chunks of beef. It's this really savory gravy. They pour that on top. They sprinkle it with a little cheese just for fun. And then they put a tomato on top instead of a cherry. So there you go. That's a hot beef sundae.
It's brilliant.
It's brilliant. And it's so, even, you know, usually it's super hot at the Iowa State Fair because it's mid-August.
Yeah.
But I don't care. I will find my way to the Cattleman's Beef Quarters and have one of these wonderful hot beef sundaes. And what makes all these food tents really extra special, whether it's the beef, the pork, the turkey, or even the lamb, the sheep burger, you know, the lamb burgers and the sheep producers that grill them, these are actual Iowa farmers that man these places.
Right.
So they take shifts, they come in, you know, different rotations, different farmers from different parts of the state every day of the fair, and they will cook your meal for you. So it's just wonderful.
I mean, that takes farm to table to a whole different level.
It does.
And a great segue into another book of yours that we absolutely have to talk about, and that is Iowa Agriculture, A History of Farming, Family, and Food. Now, you are, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, you know, you come from a long history of family farming and grew up on a century farm and then went on to do reporting in agriculture and food. So this really had to be, you know, a great work for you to do to bring all of these different threads together and tell that Iowa story of agriculture and getting a better sense, giving people a better sense of where their food comes from. I think a lot of folks associate Iowa with the breadbasket of America or the breadbasket of the world. In this case, the basket of, you know, corn and pork, but so many other things. Mm-hmm. So what went into researching this particular book?
Oh, you know, even though I'd been an ag journalist for well over 20 years when I did that book, I realized there were so many threads that I needed to pull from to make these stories come to life. Because I always tell people, I didn't write this book for farmers. I wrote this book to help just average people who eat three times a day, because if you eat three times a day, you've got a connection to agriculture, wanted to help them learn more about this amazing food system that we have today and how it's one of the most productive. We produce some of the safest, most affordable food in the world. And so it was actually really hard for me to keep this book in check in terms of the page count. And I wrote way more than I should have. And I thought, oh, the publisher will understand. And they didn't. Nope. So I had to trim a lot. So I guess that just means future books. But I try and cover everything from the crops to the livestock to innovation, women in agriculture. And with all my books, I always try and put farm recipes and just simple home cooking. So you will find recipes in all my books too, including this one.
Oh, very good. Very, very good to know. And I want to get at some examples of that. But first, I want to ask about, you know, you talk about Iowa's first farmers in this book. And you know, it's always important to recognize that, you know, while we talked about immigrants and migration, we obviously indigenous communities, indigenous individuals were really the first people here. And as you say in your book, Iowa's first farmers, you know, doing things like hunting and tapping maple trees. What could we learn about indigenous farming traditions from this book in Iowa?
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating that even in the area where I live up in west central Iowa, there's a place called Twin Lakes just north of me. And archaeological digs have shown that there was human habitation in this area 13,000 years ago, which it's just mind-boggling. So at that point, these were largely roaming hunter-gatherer type tribes, but agriculture does start appearing in these native peoples' culture quite some time ago, even 1,000 years ago. There's evidence that they were growing corn along some of the river bottoms, especially in southwest Iowa. I think with what most people in Iowa know about the native populations, they tend to think of the Meskwakis, and we still have a big Meskwaki settlement right in the center of the state at Tama, and they carry on a lot of and preserve a lot of these food traditions with the corn and the squash, and they have a wonderful museum there on the settlement that anyone can visit. But you alluded to earlier talking about in previous generations, they would tap maple trees and harvest that at certain times of the year. And it's so interesting. I've got a good friend who's an archaeologist who is up at Cherokee, Iowa, in northwest Iowa. And he talks about how we can learn a lot from the archaeological record about what these people ate, even thousands of years ago. Because when we find some of their clay pots and items that were used for cooking, you can see how the homemade clay pots not only had indentations and artwork that denoted who the woman of the house, her lineage, that all that artistry that went into those pots reflected the female legacy, which I think is fascinating. And also in those clay pots, you can see evidence of where they took sticks and made a little grid on the top of the pot. And there were indentations on the rim inside where you could put the little grid of sticks and make essentially a steamer so you could steam your food in those pots. And I believe this is actually a dig out of Kansas, not Iowa, but there have been food remains found in some of these cooking pots. And so it was a venison stew, and it was seasoned with mint and other wild herbs. So they ate very well.
It sounds that way. My goodness. Yeah. Tell me about what you learned as far as Iowa's, ecological profile that makes it such a great place to grow corn and raise pork products, because those are two things that obviously the state is very well known for.
Everything goes back to the soil. We have amazing black, rich soil, which is a gift of the prairie ecosystem that used to cover the land. But even long before there were prairies, Iowa was part of a vaster region that was covered by a shallow inland sea millions of years ago. So you can still see evidence of these little sea creatures that used to live in these warm, shallow seas. And so some of their bodies, as they died and fossilized or decayed, provided some of the minerals that make such great land here. And then also the glaciers shape so much. So the last glacier was the Wisconsin Glacier. It retreated about 12,000, 13,000 years ago. And it brought down rocks and soil and whatnot from the north. And so between those ancient seas, the glacial activity, and then the resulting prairies and the deep-rooted plants that covered most of Iowa, it created these incredible soils. And so when the native folks, of course, but when the pioneers started coming out here in the 1830s and 40s and 50s, they couldn't believe the richness of the soil. So that's what set all this in motion of us becoming a top producer of corn and pigs and other products.
Wow. I mean, and it's really that connection with the land really does drive that food story, and also makes, I think, those of us, or our listeners who may not be as familiar with what goes into producing our food, maybe gives a new perspective on, just how difficult it is and what kind of sweat equity goes into, riding that wave of being able to produce our food. I mean, you have good years and bad years. You might have fantastic soil, but if there's a drought or if there's too much rain and there's floods, I mean, all kinds of things can go into it. And Mother Nature is often in charge, but it really gives you, or at least it gives me, a great deal of respect and reverence for where our food comes from and how hard people work to get it on our tables for sure.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You're exactly right. Mother Nature is always in charge. And we were well reminded of this in the last few years. We've been going through a drought, a pretty severe one. But thank goodness we have gotten good spring rains. So we're just getting started here into spring field work. We're coming right on the cusp of spring planting. So hope springs eternal, and farmers are the eternal optimists. So we're hoping for a really good, productive year.
Well, fingers crossed on that. Now, I want to ask you about something that I'm pretty sure doesn't come from the ground or a farmer, and that is the twin bing. Tell us what the twin bing is, because that is something that I understand is a bit of a cult classic coming out of Iowa.
Yeah, the twin bing, it's a candy bar. It's got nougat and cherry flavor. It's covered with chocolate. It is a cult favorite. It's a specialty of the Palmer Candy Company out of Sioux City, Iowa, mm-hmm. in the northwest part of the state. So Palmer Candy Company has been around for a long time. I've got a section about them in my book, The Culinary History of Iowa. But yes, this twin bing that they hit upon, it's, like I say, been around over a century. There are different variations of it, some different flavors through the years. But that classic twin bing candy bar, it's one of those things you either really, really like it, or maybe you're not a huge fan. Where I really, really like it is in ice cream. So I like it in...
Interesting.
Yeah. So like Dairy Queen has Blizzards. A lot of our small town ice cream shops call them mm-hmm. Blenders or Tornadoes. So one of my favorite places to get a Twin Bing Tornado is over in Missouri Valley, Iowa, which is on the old Lincoln Highway. It's in western Iowa. Mm-hmm. And so this little ice cream shop that's been there for generations, I believe since the 60s, it's called the Dairy Den. They make these really fantastic Twin Bing Tornadoes. And I kind of go back and forth whether I like it best in vanilla soft serve or whether I like chocolate soft serve and then you mix the candy in, or sometimes I maybe just want the vanilla with a hit of chocolate syrup, and then they always give these a good dose of some cherry flavor too. So they're just really an interesting flavor combination that I really like.
That sounds very, very rich. I feel like if I had that, like I could have like one or two spoonfuls and then I'd be done.
Yeah, you know, it does sound rich, but it's really an interesting flavor profile because, yeah, you'll feel filled up after you eat one of these, but it's not so rich that it's really dense and unpleasant. It's just it's very refreshing, actually.
Huh. Well, again, I'll have to put that, I'm putting that on my list for something else I need to get and one kind of future road trip at some point that I'm going to take to Iowa.
Good.
What else do you have up your sleeve for any future books or works or articles?
Well, I've got a couple that for a number of years now, I've been doing the research. I'm trying to get the manuscript finished about Iowa's lost history on the Titanic, because there were, believe it or not, 20 some people with connections to Iowa and the Titanic, which is fascinating. And then my publisher wants me to do a book about a history lover's guide to Iowa. So I'm working on the proposal. We're in that stage at this point, but won't that be fun? Cause you know me, I'm going to put food stories in a book like that too.
Obviously, like that is, you gotta have a food story. You can't, I feel like you, at this point, you can't tell a full picture of a historical journey without talking about food. And you have done it so well, and you have such depth and breadth, particularly when it comes to Iowa. Darcy, we are so happy that you took the time to join us today. And if people want to learn more about you and your work, where can they find that?
Yeah, the best place is just to go to my website, darcymaulsby.com. So that's DarcyMaulS as in Sam, B as in boy, Y.com. And then I'm also out on Facebook and LinkedIn. So follow along, connect, and I would love to hear from people.
Well, go ahead, find Darcy. I am so glad I tracked you down, and we appreciate you sharing all of these stories with our audience.
You've been listening to Eat Your Heartland Out. This episode was produced by me, Capri Cafaro. Our audio engineers are Liam Warner and Armin Spengen. Theme music by Jason Shaw. You can learn more about the show by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/eatyourheartlandout. Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.